talking about different influences in the cosmological view that we have no inking what's happening. The beams become very smeared, the central beam, and the lobes are become predominant because they are much narrower than the beam smeared. The energy in the lobes is much more concentrated than in the main lobe. Now, how we talk to Voyager, I don't think we know that. As I told you, we don't know what we're transmitting, how we're transmitting. Tell me one little thing. Do you know how the electrical field and magnetic field is created next to our antenna? You will say yes, but I think you're wrong. We don't know that. Back to you.
KC2QAQ.
That very last statement I'm going to agree with. I've often thrown out on this TechNet, Glenn recognized, I'm going to go to you in a second. I've often thrown out the fact that how that signal transmits through space. When I listened to the Apollo astronauts, while they're on the lunar surface, and that signal was going through extremely hard vacuum of space that exists between Moon and Earth, not one single electron left that antenna. Some kind of a field or a wave left that antenna. And we can call it corpuscles, we can call it photons, we can call it ether, we can call it all kinds of things. We can give it words. I've got a very vague feeling that I don't know what really takes place when a radio antenna transmits a signal. I've put bread on my table for 35 years designing antennas that use the phenomena that I don't understand. I'm admitting that. I got this vague feeling, I don't know what's really happening. I got a lot of experiential evidence that it does happen. And a certain percentage of the time, I can predict how well it's going to happen. Not all the time. And there's a bit of magic there. The ham radio operators know that they're fiddling with that magic, the action at a distance you get. I press the key down here, and 5,000 miles away, I make a sound in the guy's set of earphones, and he hears the Morse code that I'm sending. There's a little bit of magic going on there. KC2QIQ is going to tell us how that magic takes place. Go ahead, Glenn. KQRIW.
I'm just listening to the conversation go back and forth, and actually you're both correct about certain things. But I think where the confusion is coming in the terms that you're using is that you have terrestrial signals and you have extraterrestrial signals, signals beyond the Earth. All the signals, as far as your gain numbers and focus and angles, are typically associated with everything here on Mother Earth, with respect to Earth as the ground plane. Things that are vertically polarized signals and horizontally polarized within our terrestrial area of which you're viewing waveforms. When signals are coming from space, they're dispersing, as Alex was saying before, and they are falling off at the rate that you had mentioned, Dick, 6.02 dB, as it keeps on changing as the inverse square law. But something interesting happens when you start trying to receive it here back on Earth again. You've got to put it back into a polarization and view it again. So then you go back to your gain numbers, and the gain numbers, automatically, they come back again. And it's just basically because of the difference of how you're defining your signal and your wave. On Earth, it's very simple because you're always using your horizon and your ground plane as your reference points. When you're looking at extraterrestrial, the gain numbers are different, and because you're basically just emitting an emitter into open free space, like you had said earlier. So you're kind of both saying the same things, but I'm not sure that the units and vectors is probably where you're disagreeing. KC2QIQ.
Okay, let's assume now that my tower was tall enough that I could take my 15 dB gain Yagi antenna with 19 elements on 432, assume I had direct line of sight from my top of my tower to your backyard, to where your antenna is, and I'm transmitting a horizontally polarized signal to you, and assume there's no multipath. I've got 15 dB of gain over dipole of my transmitting antenna. I know how many watts I'm putting into it, and if there was no multipath and no trees in between you and I and no buildings and whatever, you and I could calculate to the nearest half a dB, 1 dB accuracy, what signal strength you're going to get. If I then put an elevation motor on that very same 432 megacycle Yagi antenna, and I aim it up at a Oscar 10 satellite, if it was on that exact same frequency, that satellite is in space, I choose the part of of its orbit when it's at apogee at mostly almost 22,000 miles, in my particular example, and I aim my antenna at that satellite 22,000 miles above the Earth. I know where it is in space, I've used the tracking program, I know what azimuth and elevation to set my antenna, and I aim the antenna at that satellite. Are you telling me that the satellite is going to get a different polarization, a different amplitude, experience a different gain of my antenna? Will my antenna have a different beam width when I elevate it to 80 degrees above the horizon to go to that satellite versus when I aim it at you in your backyard? Is that what you're saying, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Your satellite is not yet in space. We're talking in astronomical units to get in space.
Well, let's see what Glenn's got to say about this one. In that experiment, am I going to experience a significant difference in the parameters, in the method of operation of that particular antenna that I can lay my hands on and touch and feel and shine up and whatever? Over to you, Glenn.
No, of course not. You won't. It's exactly as you're saying. Your gain, your antenna, everything's going to be exactly as it is. And the why is because you are determining the polarization. You're determining the gain because you're on a terrestrial point with Mother Earth, and that's your reference. And all of your measurements are being made with reference to your reference. Now, the interesting question that I'm surprised you didn't ask was, what is the ground plane of the satellite or the spacecraft? The answer is, it has none. There is no ground plane. It just basically has its reflective surface, and its polarization is totally irrelevant. When you're looking at something, it's always with respect to what you're measuring with. So your measurement is with respect to your Earth, your ground, and your polarity. So everything is with respect to your antenna and your receiver. But when you have two devices in space with no ground plane, and things get a lot more tricky. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, I heard an extremely weak voice, but I didn't, with earphones on, I couldn't get any audio out of it. Glenn, if I take that exact same Yagi of mine, 15 dB of gain over dipole, approximately 19 elements, 13 feet long, and I mount one of those thoroughly symmetric driven element, fed with a T-match and a folded and a half-wave coax balance, thoroughly symmetric antenna, I mount one of them on the satellite, and I use that antenna to receive what I send to the satellite and to send a signal back to me from that satellite. Is that exact same antenna in space with no local ground plane, this thoroughly symmetric antenna, hopefully with a good balance and a good impedance match on it, is it going to behave differently, the one that's on the satellite, versus the one that I've got on the top of my tower? Over to you, Glenn.
Going to behave exactly the same, but here again, what is your ground plane, what is your point of reference, and what is your polarity? In other words, now your new Mother Earth or your new polarity point becomes that satellite, and it becomes the reference point, and everything with respect to around it has to be referenced now to that satellite. Does that make sense, KC2, QIQ?
Einstein will say that's all relative.
Yeah, everything is relative. That's what Einstein said, relativity. Okay. On the satellite, there's something they call bond coordinates. On Earth, you and I use usually a set of coordinates of azimuth and elevation. If I was an astronomer, I use a set of coordinates called right ascension and declination. If I was a real good radio astronomer, I would start using galactic coordinates, which are the equivalent of right ascension and declination in a coordinate system relevant to the galaxy, our particular galaxy, the Milky Way. But once I define it, the so-called bond coordinates of that satellite tell me that the satellite knows where the North Pole and the South Pole of the Earth is. The satellite knows where the eastern horizon and the western horizon is. And yes, if the satellite is rotating and I've got a linear polarized antenna on the satellite and a linear polarized antenna in my backyard, yes, I'm going to see some wow. I'm going to see the signal go up and down as I go cross-pole and co-pole when the satellite rotates. And in that particular case, if I'm smart enough, at least on one end, I'm going to have a circular polarized antenna, either on the satellite or on the Earth. But once I define the coordinate system of the satellite, once the satellite is smart enough with its inertial referencing system, and once I know what the reference of the satellite is, and I know how I've set my antenna in my backyard, assuming the satellite is not rotating now, what stops me from having proper polarization, proper azimuth and elevation on both my ground antenna and the satellite antenna? I've got no reference ground plane on the antenna. I'm not using a quarter wave ground plane antenna. I'm using a thoroughly symmetric driven element fed Yagi antenna on the satellite in this theoretical thought experiment you and I are doing right now, Glenn. So if I've got enough knowledge of how the satellite is oriented and where it is with reference to me, where's the problem? KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
Now you and Alex should be in agreement, because that's what I think the difference was. The point was that what was the vector, what was the polarity, where was it moving from, at what point was the signal taking off, and what was your aperture, and what were you looking at? I think now that you've put the definitions in place, you and Alex should be in agreement now. KC2QIQ.
Just think, Alex, there's another man putting words into your mouth. N2NNU is going to defend himself. K2RIW in the group.
I will not defend myself because there is no need to. Glenn actually confirmed that what I'm saying is true, and actually said that you are right too. So it's all a matter of perspective, you know, like looking to the fish from the two perspectives, front end or from a side. You see two different animals, but in fact there is one. How about my circulators, Dick?
Okay, I'll give you a quick explanation of a circulator. And believe it or not, it's relatively close to what goes on with a Yig-tuned filter. Yig material, yttrium iron garnet, the kind of a magic material that has a precession characteristic to its molecules. There's an electron going around a nucleus of the molecule of the Yig material. And in the case of a spinning top, a toy top, we've all seen a top as it spins down. It wiggles in a particular manner that's called precessing. And the magnetic field created by an orbit of an electron around the nucleus of the atom or the molecule of these kinds of materials has a similar kind of precession phenomena. When you put a externally created magnetic field through the material, through the Yig material, through the gyrotropic material. This phenomenon I'm describing is called gyrotropy. When you've got this fancy kind of ferrite-like material, magnetic material, and you put an external magnetic field across it, you change the rate of the precession. Very similar to what would happen with that toy top. If I spun the toy top at a particular rate, and I measured the rate at which the top precesses, and then I do something to double the gravity field that the top is in as it's spinning on the floor, it would precess at twice the rate. So the way you apply external forces, in the case of gravity with a child's top, creates precession when the top is rotating around its axis at a particular rate. So with the gyrotropic material, you change the precession rate when you change the magnetic field. Okay. As you change the magnetic field and you adjust that precession rate to be equal to the rate that you care about, if I want to tune my Yig filter to 3 gigahertz, I will put in the right strength of magnetic field so that that material precesses at a 3 gigahertz rate. That will couple energy between my input coil and my output coil of my Yig filter. And that's how the primary and the secondary that are orthogonal to each other talk to each other. That's how a Yig filter works.
Repeater.
I know it's going to take a bit of a leap of faith, but once I've got the right strength of magnetic material, the right strength of externally caused magnetic field on gyrotropic material, and I've got a thin hockey puck of gyrotropic material, I got two hockey pucks. I've got a printed circuit that goes down the center of the circulator. If you took apart the circulator and you look at that printed circuit, it is in the shape of a Y. I've got one particular input terminal of 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to call 1 my input, 2 my output, and 3 my termination. And I've got on top and bottom of this printed circuit center conductor Y-shaped thing, I've got a slab of this gyrotropic material above and below, and I've got a magnetic structure around it so that the magnetic field going through the gyrotropic material is affecting it. The bottom line is now, the signal that I put into port number one of this Y-shaped object, in theory, is capable of coming out of port number two and port number three with equal amplitude before I do anything. The signal that goes from port one to port two, I'm going to call it the clockwise propagating signal. The signal that goes from port one to port three directly, I'm going to call it the counterclockwise signal. When I've got the right kind of gyrotropic material and the right amount of magnetic field, the velocity of propagation clockwise and the velocity of propagation counterclockwise are two different velocities. When I set it up just right, the signal that flows clockwise has a certain time delay to get to port number two, from port one to port number two. The signal that starts off at port number one and goes around the other way, port number three, has got a different length of time to get there. Because of my magnetic field and the sense of material, I get two different velocities of propagation, clockwise and counterclockwise. When I set it up just right, and I set those phase angles just right, phase length just right, the signals add co-phase on port number two, and they cancel on port number three. So, signal starting off at port number one, essentially all of it ends up at port number two, none of it ends up at port number three. When I put in a signal at port number two, it propagates clockwise to port number three, the terminal
repeater.
I put in a signal at port number two. Again, you've got clockwise and counterclockwise. The signal in port number two ends up at port number three, where I've got a termination. And it cancels at port number one. So the bottom line of all this is it's kind of a diode action as far as the radio signal is concerned. When my circulator is operating correctly at my design frequency, essentially everything I put in at port number one ends up at port number two. Everything I put in at port number two ends up at port number three, which is terminated. Doesn't get back to port number one. So the beauty of this device is that it allows the signal to flow forward and won't allow anything to come back. One crazy way I could use it is I've got this great amplifier, which I like using. It's got a low noise amplification, but it happens to have a really terrible input standing wave ratio. It's got an S11 that's very close to 0 dB. Of all the energy I try to put into this amplifier, a high percentage of it bounces back to me, and it gives me some kind of grief in my circuit. I don't want that to happen. If I put a circulator in front of this yucky amplifier of mine, which had a really terrible standing wave ratio, now I apply the signal to port one, number one of the circulator, it comes out of port number two, goes into the amplifier. Every signal that reflects out of the input circuit of that amplifier comes back into port number two, doesn't come back to me at port number one, it goes to port number three, which is terminated. I never see any reflections anymore if the circulator is ideal. You carefully tune the circulator. And I've done that on one occasion. You can make the directivity 45 decibels. You can make the insertion loss 1/10 of a decibel. The signal I apply to port number one comes out of port number two, 1/10 of a dB attenuated. That's almost nothing. The signal coming back from port number two to port number one is 45 dB weaker. It's essentially nothing. It forces the signal to flow in one direction. There's many places where that's a very handy characteristic with amplifiers and mixers and ways of making hybrid-like structures and signal summers. I mean, I can put circulators I can put filter elements on port number two where certain signals get absorbed, certain signals get reflected. I can control where certain frequencies go and don't go. There's lots of ways you can use a circulator
repeater.
There's lots of ways you can use a circulator once you've got it. I didn't give you the complete explanation of how it works. I told you from a user's point of view and from a guy who has taken them apart, looked inside. I personally have added and subtracted magnetic field of a working circulator. I could take a circulator that somebody has carefully tuned it to 10.0 gigahertz, and I happen to like the ham radio band at 10.368. If I increase the magnetic field by putting a proper polarization of a refrigerator magnet on the outside, I add some magnetic field, I can force that circulator that was beautifully tuned at 10 gigs, I can move it up to 10.368. Easy. I can move it up, I can move it down by changing the strength of the magnetic field once you know how it works. That's a very simple process. I don't have to climb inside to really tune it. I can do it from the outside. That's one of the many tricks that ham radio operators have done. That gives you a little more information about a circulator. You've now, You now know 20% of what you'd like to know, I think. N2NNU, with some more questions. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I guess I have to do my homework. It appears to be more complex than I thought. But I think what, in essence, it is a directional isolator. And that's what I was looking for. Okay, Dick, thank you for the explanation. Back to you.
And by the way, you don't have to put a termination on the third port. I could set it up in such a way that the signals I apply to port number one come out of port number two and look at a bandpass filter. And the signals that go through the bandpass filter go beyond the filter where it presents a 50 ohm termination and go to the rest of the circuit on the far side of that filter. Most of the filters you and I use are reflective objects on the reject frequency. So the frequencies that get rejected by the filter come back reflected into port number two and proceed to port number three where I've got another filter. So I can, in a lossless manner, I can connect multiple filters at multiple frequencies to the right kind of a circulator that's broadband enough, and I can select where everything goes. It's just one of the many things you can do with a circulator. Very handy item. Whenever you're working with amplifiers that you're summing together, and you want isolation between the amplifiers, because if the signal from amplifier one sees amplifier number two and vice versa, they can break into oscillation. You put circulators in the right place, and you can make an unstable system very stable and have a negligible increase in the insertion loss in the process of doing it. Very handy item. Mel, what's the mail been like tonight? And you've been kind of quiet tonight. I expected you to get into some of this jazz. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Now, I've been taking this all in, and I agree and disagree. Bottom line is, as you said, no research program is 100% guaranteed, but if we don't try, we will never know. It's a shame that if I came to government, I have a very good idea to develop something that may find. They may fund me and not fund me, but if I came there and I said, I've got an idea that is still more human beings, would you fund the research for me to complete project? Guarantee, which project do you think would get funding, Dick? Over.
Yeah, when we've got a wartime mentality, as we sometimes have, you're sort of right, unfortunately. There's a significant number of people who think if you've got a real good killing machine that properly used, it's going to give you great defense. I know that Oppenheimer was rather unhappy about the potential application of nuclear weapons. Well, he invented a nuclear bomb, and whether or not he intended it to be used as a human being killing weapon is debatable. I know that he suddenly rapidly realized what it is about to be used for, and it did get used for that process, and it bothered the living daylights out of him, and it bothered him so much that he behaved in ways that were not well understood by our government, and they took away his security clearance, even though he was in one of the most secure locations in the world at the time. So, yep, that's a tough one. Can we defend a nation without ever using machines that can create harm? Darn interesting question. Has any race, there's been lots and lots of wars won and lost on planet Earth in the last 2,000 years. I'm just going to choose 2,000 years. Lots of wars have been won and lost. Can you and I defend my territory, assuming that we think that we're valid in defending it, that we want to defend it, and that's the moral thing to do? Can we defend that territory without using objects of destruction? In an ideal world, yes. Has anyone in 2,000 years succeeded in doing that? What's the history of that concept? It's an interesting question to ask. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You're talking about teleportation, Dick.
I'm going to take all the bad guys and ship them to elsewhere, some other place at some other time, and get them out of our hair. Great idea. We have to invent that. It's going to take money to invent that. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY.
Just don't send them to Yonkers.
You got it, Mel.
Okay. All right. Well, as you said, the history of humankind, not a great history. In fact, I will defend Alex in only one respect. That if there is a planet somewhere similar to us out there somewhere, let's say they evolved, but maybe on a different track, that they're not, you know, have this mentality of this brutality mentality that seems to be prevalent in mankind here on the Earth. I maybe they monitor several radio programs, whatever. Why would you want to make contact with this place? Have a society that is likely, every thousand years, would still like we have progress anymore, become more efficient at killing. We're more barbaric. You know, we talk about the barbarism of a long time ago. They are just like amateurs, really, compared to what we are. Why? Because we do it clean, drop a bomb from 1,000 feet out of the bottom of a bomber. That less barbaric, that I just clubbing another one over the head. Now, it sounds ridiculous, but I would say that, there, you know, case right now, we should be very careful what we're funding. Not to really make economy the way it is. Love research, you know, I'm all for it. Create jobs, create better living for most of us, in much better condition. Not compare what riches of the rich couldn't live like some of the poor technology and research. Got to be careful the country is in and the rest of the world is in over.
Yeah, what I think you're saying is that you right now, because of our terrible economic situation, you want to defend, you want to fund only the projects that are so-called shovel-ready, sort of a Work Projects Administration, sort of a repeat of what FDR did after the Great Depression. We want to repeat some of that successful operation. Shovel-ready projects that put people to work, fix the infrastructure, make life better, and so on. I can understand that. However, when it comes to all of the life that Alex is positive is out there, and Alex is alone on that one, there's a significant percentage of the population, for either religious or other reasons, believe that the Earth is unique, that the intelligent life in this universe is only concentrated on this planet, and he, capital H, put it there and wanted it to be there. There's a significant percentage of the population that believes that. And not everyone believes quite as globally as Alex does, saying that, hey, I accept the fact that life is universal. You take the right raw ingredients, you mix well, wait a long time, and life will happen every time. The Stanley Miller experiment strongly suggests that. That life will happen every time if you get the right ingredients and you wait long enough. Let me drop. Of all the life that's out there, we're slowly discovering that we don't have the world's best planet. We don't have the world's best sun. We don't have the world's best solar system. We don't have the universe's best planetary system. We don't have the world's best galaxy. We don't have the universe's best galaxy. We're in the middle of everything is what we're slowly discovering. We're being humbled for the sixth, seventh, or eighth time. We've got a nice planet, a nice sun, a nice location, a nice solar system, a nice galaxy, a nice local galactic group in an average position of a galaxy. There's one way of looking at it. We're in the middle of everything. And the universe, as we know it, appears to have been around for something like 13.2 billion years since the Big Bang. In that 13.2 billion years, I guarantee that some of that life out there has gotten a huge head start on us. They're a million or a billion years ahead of us, and they got information we could use. Should they give it to us? Would they destabilize our society? The societies that accomplish something, technologically speaking, have curiosity. That's where it comes from. If you ain't curious, you ain't going to make progress. That's what I strongly believe. And so all of these crazy projects of NASA is demonstrating curiosity. Are we alone? Is there other life out there? And if there is life, they've had a great big head start. The fact that they've had that big head start and have accomplished something and they're still around says that they've got curiosity and they solved their problem of killing each other. That's why they're still there. So when we discover, just not if, but when, and I don't know if it's going to be a year or 1,000 years from now, but when we discover that other life and communicate with it by whatever means, they have solved the problems, at least many of the problems that we're working on right now. They've figured out how to stop killing each other. They've solved many of the problems of disease and cancer and whatever. And they've made technological progress with their curiosity. And they've got something to offer. Should they offer it to us, or would they be destabilizing this planet, the so-called...
Oceans.
What did NASA call it? The prime directive. Don't disturb the society. Don't reveal your presence, because if they're going through these transitional periods of figuring out how to be stable, you're going to destabilize them. So for that
repeater,
you're already in the oceans.
So for that reason, they're not going to give us this great information. But who knows? You won't know until you try. You can't prove there was never a pink elephant unless you start a search for one. You can't prove that there was life or not life somewhere else until you start the search. Should you put a whole lot of your resources into that? Probably not. Should you put zero resources into it? You can make a strong case for that also, that you shouldn't respond that way. Because there are certain people who get very excited by the fact of doing a kind of research into an area that has never been investigated before. It gives a certain percentage of the population a hell of a lot of motivation to go on living. It gives them purpose. I've often said a dumb goal is a hell of a lot better than no goal. We've all met people who have no goals. The saddest situation I can remember is when I was the main television repair person in the town of Middle Island, Long Island, 1956 time frame. I went into a couple of the houses where I'm repairing the television set, and the person says, "Thank goodness you're here. You're fixing the set. I can now watch my soap operas." These are retired people, and a couple of those people were saying to me, "My children have graduated. They're out of the house. I'm waiting to die." And these are people 50 years of age. The television was supplying their entertainment that made them go on living. They had no other goal. That's what happens.
Really nice.
That's what can happen to a person who loses goal and loses motivation. They sit around and wait to die. And that, to me, is a terrible waste. You've got to have curiosity. To support that curiosity, a certain amount of crazy research has to go on. That's an opinion. Let's see what the mailbag from Mel is saying. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Just a courage.
Go ahead, Alex.
Well, just making sure that progress is not the child of curiosity. Progress is the child of need. We invented fire because we needed fire. We invented a car because we needed a car. We invented rockets because we needed rockets. Curiosity is just occurs after you have the tool. Basic monkey judgment. Back to you.
A number of projects, a number of things were discovered without the need. Serendipity struck when epoxy was discovered. Somebody was experimenting with polymers, a chemist in the laboratory. When he was through mixing the polymer one day, he laid the spoon on the table, came back the next morning and couldn't remove the spoon. And he said, "What is that substance?" And that was epoxy. He wasn't seeking to make a great adhesive. He was doing some kind of an experiment. He got this crazy result. He couldn't remove the spoon from the table, and his curiosity drove him to find out what the hell is the property that's doing that. So you're absolutely right. Mother necessity is the mother of invention. I'm going to give you 90% of the time, but 10% of the time, curiosity can say, "Hey, I got a result that's different than I expected. Let's find out why." That's not just out data that I'm going to throw away. Mother Nature is telling me something. If I've got the curiosity, I'm going to find out what Mother Nature is saying, and there's a certain percentage of the time where that unknown information is going to be darn useful. That's an opinion. Oh, you got it, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
W2EWK.
Glenn and Eugene in that order. Glenn first, go ahead.
Yeah, I've always heard that necessity is the mother of invention, but as being an engineer, I found it's always been necessity has always been the mother of funding. But then again, that's just my opinion, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, without money, it's hard to do things. The age of the independent Edison who does things all by himself, not backed up by a big organization. There aren't very many of those, but there are a few. Don't give up. Eugene, what would you do if you had the choice of how to spend all the resources of the United States? Would you do some research to be 2EWK, K2RIW?
Well, let me say something to you there, Dick. You know how big Fire Island is, you know, Fire Island? You know how much grain of sand they got there on the beach, right? Now, picture this. Picture all these planets, you know, up in the sky that have all these grains of sand, okay? All these grains of sand. Now,
Now, tell me something. When God came to Earth, and they said that he made all these planets and that stuff, but how come he's not around anymore? Did he just left us, or is he still around? Is he still coming back? What happened to him? How come he's not making more planets and more people and that stuff, you know, more trees and that stuff? That's my curiosity, Dick. Back to you, W2EWK.
I can only give you a partial answer for this one, Eugene. You know that there's a whole science called radio astronomy. And in Green Bank, West Virginia, I have on a number of occasions visited the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And the United States has got a big one. England has got a big one. France has got a big one. Australia has got a big one, and so on. By way of radio astronomy, by way of astronomy, optical astronomy, infrared astronomy, and so on, by way of the various kinds of astronomy, which doesn't put a single bit of food on the plate of any human being on planet Earth, but by way of the curiosity represented by all of the astronomies, look into the right place in space, you can watch dusty material forming into stars. You can watch the dusty material forming into stars, forming into planets around the stars. You can watch it happening. There's lots of places in space where brand new planets are being created, and brand new stars, after 10 billion years, are becoming unstable, going into a supernova, exploding, and everything around it dies. There's death and destruction and birth going on continuously. Just look into the right place at the right time. He doing that there instead of here? I don't know. Was he ever here? I'm not positive. There are a lot of people who are. Is the right way to figure out all of this jazz the religious way, the scientific way, the astrology way? You got lots of ways of looking at this thing. How did you get here? Where are you going? What's the purpose of it all? You can ask those questions till the cows come home. There's no simple, easy answer to any of that. That's a given. If you've got the curiosity, you're going to seek and you're going to find some of the answers. You'll always discover there's more unknown that's known. That's the human condition. With curiosity, you will learn more. And you will learn some of the truth, and some of the truth will set you free, it says here. I ain't so sure about that all the time. So there's no easy answer to that one, Alec. You've asked Eugene, you've asked a really tough question. And you're going to have to find somebody smarter than the group in this particular gathered group to get a real good answer to it, I'm afraid to say. But when Mel digs into his mailbag, he gets...
Repeater.
Another one.
All right. You've given us a real tough one with the first one. Try to make the next one a little easier, Eugene. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm curious.
Okay, W2EWK. Okay, you know how big space is. You know, has big space is. You know, it's a lot of space out there. Now, if you took a rocket ship and went straight ahead, will you come up to a wall? Will you come up to more space? What's out there, Dick? What is out in outer space? How big can it be? You know, we're very little tiny, tiny people over here. Biggest outer space. How large is it? How large? Tell me, Dick, W3WK.
You're glad he asked that question.
I'm glad he kept it simple, just like I said. I asked him to ask a nice, simple question. It goes on to infinity, Eugene. There ain't no end. That's a hard one to wrap your brain around. There ain't no end. And we think that this solar system, midway between downtown and the suburbs of this particular galaxy, that's a member of this particular galactic group, in this particular universe, and we think that's all there is. I'm seeing lots of evidence there are multiple universes, multiverses. That material out at the perimeter of our universe that's accelerating away from us is being sucked over the hill into the next galaxy, is my belief. There can't be an end, Eugene. If there was an end to the universe, eventually you and I are going to go out there and drill a hole in that wall and find out what's beyond it. There can't be an end. That's not an easy one to accept, I know. Glenn, did you say you wanted to say something about this?
EC2QIQ, if you'll allow me to.
Go for it. You got the floor, and make it simple, because Eugene is giving us some really tough questions tonight.
Well, Eugene, the way I understand it is that if you look out into the sky in any direction that you look at, north, south, east, west, look through the earth and look all the way down on every side that you look at, that's the beginning of time. That's where everything began. And we're actually, in all the planets and everything you see around us, is something in between that's taking place since that beginning of time. But if you add up all that area on the outside that you can look at every possible furthest direction, that's the beginning of time. KC2, QIQ.
Comment.
Go ahead, Eugene. I see your point of view on all this. Where's the end of it all, Alex?
As you said, it never ends. For all of those that are searching for those questions, there is a tremendous book, and I will recommend everybody to read it. It's called Siddhartha, written by Hermann Hesse. Oh, God, if you read that book, you will have all the answers that you ever required. On a more personal thing, first of all, I am an atheist. I don't believe in God, I don't believe in the devil, I don't believe in anything. Anyhow. But what I believe is that we are here on Earth to become the gods of the universe. While I say that there might be other life forms out there, I didn't say that as a certainty. Statistically, I said there might be other life forms, but I think our main mission in this universe is to become the gods of other planets or other places. And very soon we're going to do like Isaac Asimov in his foundation. We will not even remember where Terra is. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, if our purpose is to be the gods of this local place and the places around it, who assigned us that goal or purpose? Where did that assignment come from?
From me.
That purpose to ourselves in our quest. And the question why we are here, we don't even know that we have already the answer. That's why we are here, to become the gods of the rest of the universe. But it's not obvious to everybody, that's all.
I thought it came from me, and to VUU that has been listening to this net for the last 2 hours, and everything is all said, is everything I wanted to ask a question on, which is all answered it, because these are the questions I would ask too. And Eugene, I know you how many years? Don't ask a question like that again. No. There's nothing behind the wall. I used to think that too. That's a common phenomenon. There must be a wall, right? Dick said, and everybody else. No wall. And if there's a wall, is there a door? If there's a door and you open it, is there a cool beer out there waiting for me? And to VUU.
Okay, Frank. Sounds like you've got it pretty well figured out. Okay. Ain't it amazing that the technical net, the original concept is that we're going to understand ham radio. But, let's face it, hams are humans, and hams have to face the human condition. And we've got to decide how much of our time is going to be spent on making the antenna work, making the transmitter work, keeping the kids happy, keeping food on the table, understanding the nature of the universe, understanding the nature of the deity. So, hams are curious people. It's part of how you got into this hobby. Some of these questions, I guess hams are afraid to ask them, but maybe this is an open enough forum where people lose that fear and are willing to ask. Frank, if you were asked, if you felt comfortable enough from Holbrook, which is a town I travel through every time I go to work these days. I go through Holbrook to get to Holtzville. What question would you ask if you felt comfortable enough, Frank? Go ahead.
If I felt comfortable enough, I'm always comfortable. I just took my pill for pain, which I go through night and day, chronic pain. But that's a different story. If I was comfortable enough, what question would I ask now on the net? Is that what you're implying?
Yeah, assuming these guys have got almost enough smarts to partially answer some of your questions, what do you really want to know about? What are you seeking, Frank? What is a curious guy in Holbrook seeking? Go ahead, Frank.
Remember me, huh? You know, everybody, it's pathetic, everybody out there tonight asked every question that I've already asked myself about a million times. after being around 66 years. About how old I am. I think March 19th. And pick me up something nice, huh? I'll come over and visit you and your mother. A little bit of a tickaloon. Was that a lunatic? But that's Eugene. He ticks a loon. I don't know what question I'd ask. The only question I'd ask is a terrestrial question. When is the economy going to improve? Now, don't puke in a basket after I ask that.
Think I got another one.
Oh, boy. You gave us two tough ones already, Eugene. And I want to know about the economy, too. I mean, I worked for a whole lot of years. I put a lot of money into a retirement nest egg. I wanted the nest egg to stay there so that I would have a certain amount of economic security in my so-called retirement. Well, I thought I retired 8 years ago, 9 years ago. Here I am working every day. And so I want the economy to recover. And I might not be the only one. But Eugene, he was smart enough not to put his money in the stock market. Therefore, he's not losing it. He put it in the bank. I wish I had diversified by putting the money not under one mattress, but under four or five different mattresses. I would be a lot more secure if I had diversified in the number of mattresses I put my money under. W2EWK. Go ahead, Eugene. K2RIW.
Okay, W2EWK. Okay, Dick, I have another one very, very, technical. I don't know if you could do it or not. Like a person like you, you've got two eyes. You know, you got two ears, you got two feet, you got all this stuff growing around you, like trees and nature and that stuff, and dogs and cats and animals and that stuff. How do you all these things got here so perfect? Did the Big Bang got us over here? You know, did it happen like that, or... or we're just kind of some kind of freak from another planet. Somehow I had a dream one day that we all came from a different planet and we got all rejected from another planet and they stuck us over here, Dick, W2EWK.
Dick, you sure you want to answer that?
Yeah, is this purgatory? Is this hell? Is this heaven? Is this none of the above? Going to have to eventually at least consider evolution process that Darwin seemed to put us on that particular path. I think he didn't have the whole answer, but he had a lot of the answers as far as the fossil record is concerned. So one strong interpretation by a lot of fairly smart people, not absolute proof, of the fossil record is that many, many animals evolved. A horse was once an animal about the size of a small dog and slowly evolved into a much larger animal. And if you collect enough of the fossil records over enough thousands of years, you can watch that animal slowly become bigger and bigger. It was to his advantage to do that. So evolution took place. And we had an awful tough time with figuring out that birds seem to have an origin of reptiles. And how the heck did some reptiles suddenly develop feathers? And how do you develop enough feathers to do flying? Well, in China, in the last few years, they have found an intermediate fossil reptile that had feathers on its hind feet and its front feet, and it was capable of jumping out of a tree and using those feathers to slowly descend to the ground to a different place. That was the beginning of flight. So there is reasonably strong evidence that birds did evolve from reptiles, and that intermediate animal, the fossil record for him, seems to have been found. There's a lot of evidence for evolution. Evolution, survival of the fittest. Turns out that because of cosmic rays and a hell of a lot of other things, each individual birth is not perfect. Certain animals, you can have two perfect parents give birth, let me drop, to an offspring, and the offspring will be a little bit different. Some errors occur. 99% of the time, the error is a disadvantage, and the animal is going to suffer. A certain very small percentage of the time, the error that occurs is an advantage, and that animal has a better chance of surviving and possibly passing on that trait to his offspring. That may be one of the mechanisms of evolution. So, you and I have a body that has what you would think is an extremely good design. And you're going to say, it couldn't have happened by accident. by way of the evolutionary process, it appears that it could have. Now, did a higher thinking being create the process of the evolution by which the design improvement took place? Lots of people believe that. Lots of people believe in spontaneous creation. If you add up all of the begats in the Bible, you'll come up with something like 5,000 years. And there's a significant number of people of a spiritual background, a religious background, who truly believe that this whole earth inhabited by human beings is only 5,000 years. And that there are fossil records of man-like animals 3 million years old, they think it's just an error in interpreting the data. Lots of ways of interpreting this. No easy answers to all of it. But as I said, Mel's mailbag and the questions that we get from that source sometimes get us back to putting our feet on the ground. What do you think, Mel? You think we should put our feet back on the ground? K2KEY, what kind of good questions you get from your mailbag this week that we're supposed to be answering? K2LIW, the Tech Man.
Thing to say, Dick.
Yeah, I think we've got to go to a little bit of the mailbag, and then with the time left over, we'll come back to some of these lofty questions. And there's no good answers for any of them, I'll warn you. Go ahead, Mel.
Can I just say one more thing for you?
Okay, are we going ahead? What do you want to do, Dick? Tell me.
I think for at least a little while, we should go to real hard ham radio questions that you got in your mailbag. Go ahead.
Not fair. Ask people to, I try to answer about, especially. I'm just looking through. Okay, here's very interesting. I am interested in up 160 meters. Don't really have the room for it. I'd like to more or less stuff as much wire as possible as the counterpoise, the radial, possible to foreshore I use in pieces. That's an interesting question coming from. I remember an article written that can foreshore in pieces of coax. What do you think?
Yeah, once you decide to build an antenna for a frequency as low as 160 meters, where a full half-wave dipole would be, 265 feet long, and I highly like symmetric antennas, dipole-like antenna, where the left side and the right side work against each other. You don't need a great big ground plane system. Without a doubt, there's ways you can take a dipole and you can zigzag it and put loading coils and top hat capacitors. There's all kinds of ways you can squeeze down a dipole. Go over to a ground plane antenna. There's all kinds of ways you can squeeze it down. The driven element of the ground plane antenna, you can use loading coils and zigzag and top loading capacitors. The ground plane radials, you can use loading coils, zigzagging, and pieces of coax where you're feeding the center conductor and the shield is not connected at the center, but it's connected somewhere else. There are various ways you can make the ground plane radials electrically appear to be the right length, which is in the vicinity of 130 feet long, but physically they're a hell of a lot shorter. You can do that. And you can resonate the ground plane radials, and you can resonate the driven element. That's the good news. And because you can resonate it, you think it's going to work well. Well, it ain't quite that easy. The whole idea of the ground plane radials is that it's a poor man's equivalent to try to make the quarter wave radiator look like it's operating against an infinite sheet of copper that goes off to infinity in all directions. That's the most ideal ground plane antenna. Let me drop. The most ideal ground plane antenna that'll have 100% efficiency is you got a quarter wave or a half wave radiator. Make the radiator whatever length you like. But it should have a counterpoise that's a sheet of copper that goes off to infinity in all directions. You have the resources to do that. You will have 99.9% radiation efficiency. You put 100 watts of that into that antenna, and 99.9 watts is radiated into space. That's the good news. Now let's get realistic. You and I can't do that. We're doing a poor man's equivalent when you lay out the quarter wave radiators 132 feet long in every direction. That's a ground plane antenna that has reasonable efficiency. Lay down 32 of those radials full length, and you'll end up with something like 90% efficiency. You're still putting RF energy into the earth near the antenna and around the outside of that perimeter of ground plane radials. You didn't make it an infinite sheet of copper. You did an equivalent, a substitute. Whereas in the case of a dipole, don't have to lay down a zillion radiators, radials. It is its own counterpoise. It's a balanced antenna. I'll admit that a vertically polarized 160-meter antenna is beyond even what the guys in Dover Street in Brooklyn can do and what the guys on Vanderbilt Parkway in Huntington can do. It's way beyond their capability. So you're going to have to use some kind of squeezing down. And now, once you've decided you're going to squeeze the antenna down, should it be a squeezed-down ground plane? Should it be a squeezed-down dipole? Whether that dipole is horizontal or vertical, it is my belief you're going to get more bang for the dollar with the dipole antenna. The antenna that has its own counterpoise built into it, a thoroughly balanced antenna. I'm not a strong believer in unbalanced antennas. You can do a lot of fiddling with these ways of squeezing down the size. You can end up with looks like good standing wave ratio on a squeezed down ground plane non-symmetric antenna. But if you had the ability to measure the amount of radiation efficiency, you're going to find out an awful lot of your RF energy is heating up the local soil and making the worms happy in the wintertime because they can feel the heat when you press down the key. But not all of that energy is going to be radiating the
repeater.
Not all of that energy is going to be radiating the space in the direction you would like. So the fact that you can force it down to a small physical size, that only brings you halfway to home plate. That's only half the battle to resonate the antenna in a small physical size. The next thing you should ask yourself, do you think you're going to like the efficiency of that? By way of the modeling programs that are available to you, you can calculate ahead of time that efficiency. And I think the answer you're going to get is within a few percent of error. Not a very large error. You can model that antenna and decide whether or not you're going to be happy with it even before you exert all the resources to buy or build it. But a 160-meter antenna, I would much rather put up a shrunk-down dipole and live with the fact that it's going to be narrowband, mounted as high as I can get. The other thing I don't like about a ground plane antenna is that its center, its phase center, is down at the earth level, as low as you can get. That's a significant disadvantage. You got two disadvantages there. You're radiating from a low place, and you're radiating with relatively low efficiency. As you can tell, I'm not a big believer in ground plane antennas. I may be wrong on this one. There are obviously people out there that will strongly disagree with me. You won't have to go very far to find a couple of guys who've got a ground plane antenna, and they'll say it's the best thing since baked bread, and boy, I love it. I can find you an awful lot of guys who have tried to measure the efficiency of a ground plane, and they weren't too happy with the results. Whereas with a properly fed dipole, even one that's been physically decreased in size, if you mount it as high as your resources, the tallest tree you've got on the property, I think you're going to get more bang for the dollar. But that's an opinion. Let's see what the guys in Brooklyn have done and see what Mel thinks about all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2KEY. Well, I can only tell you that, yes, I know where this came from. But there's been a lot of talk about getting on Magic Band, another one of these magic, what happened to someone. I'm touting you about the what. Some years ago, there were book printed to try to show you all getting on a low band, one antenna. What they said is you put it along the top of wire as possible. In other words, stretch out a wire as long as possible as you possibly can stretch out. Try to get at least, say, 100, 135 feet or whatever I pull on 160. Then you drop a wire down from the middle of the top section. You drop a wire down somewhere in the middle, the highest that you possibly could put this wire. Counterpoises, rather than have 5 foot of counterpoises, if you can't manage this, can use coax cable and a velocity factor, fixed velocity factor, quarter wavelength times 0.66 foot radial distance.
But in order to experience the 66% velocity factor of that coax mill, you have to be feeding semiconductor versus shield. So are you saying you conduct this, you've got your ring at the base of your ground plane where you're going to connect your ground plane radials? Are you going to connect the semiconductor of the coax cables there, leave the shields open, and then do something at the far end, like either shorting the semiconductor to shield? What did the design do to use that velocity factor? If I took the coax cable apart and removed the shield and just laid down the dielectric, the polyethylene material in the semiconductor, and laid that into the ground, I wouldn't experience that 66% velocity factor anymore. It takes that outer shield to do that. So how are you going to use the coax cables as the ground plane radials? Back to you, Mel.
The way it was originally described of, you know, I'm getting